So you drink unsweetened cinnamon light soy lattes?
I do. Mm. It's like Christmas in a cup.
Hello and welcome to this year's Christmas special of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. I'm once again here joined by Julie. Hey, Julie.
Happy Christmas, Matt.
Happy Christmas to you too. We will be talking about the topic that basically determined most of our summer. We had this lost summer, four episodes where we focused on films that were lost, filmmakers that were lost to us. We will jump right into one of our contributions, namely Alan's.
Greetings to everyone in the damn fine universe at this, my brief reflection on the losses, rediscoveries and discoveries of 2025, with an asterisk that obviously it's not going to include David Lynch. We've covered him quite a lot this year. I think cinematically, the other big losses of the year that really got me going back to their work and realizing just how talented they were, I think would count for both Gene Hackman and Diane Keaton. I think both are incredible actors. And I think it was great in their memory to go back and dig out just some of their performances and realize just how both of them had an incredible talent for drama and also comedy, and the way their comedy both could make comedy feel very emotional. They could sell that the characters really believed something, even if the line was also quite funny. And I do think, going back to the Royal Tannenbaums, that Gene Hackman's performance in that is incredible. It's really someone who is putting in his A game that sort of relatively late in life. It's and apparently not entirely convinced by the script, apparently, behind the scenes, but it just does not show. It's an incredible performance. But that's the sort of movie side of things. I think quite a few deaths in the world of music affected me this year. I'm thinking especially Tom Lehrer, Brian Wilson, Sly Stone. I mean, the first of which was probably expected given his age, but you know, when the news comes out, it still feels a big deal. But all those deaths got me back to listening to the music and again, appreciating the genius. Another loss this year, which facilitated or sent me on a massive rabbit hole that I enjoyed, which had all the sort of melancholy of loss and reminiscing, even if I don't think necessarily a heroic figure, was the loss of someone called Jim Shooter, who was the editor-in-chief at Marvel in the 80s, which was very much my heyday of getting involved in comics. He attracts different opinions from the people he worked with. And it was interesting going back to the people speaking about him, the pros and cons. It felt like a very sort of honest reflection of someone's life. I mean, as editor-in-chief, he always had to deal with the egos of the writers who wanted to do stuff set against, you know, the bosses that wanted corporate product, IP, toys, and how he handled that. You know, it wasn't always great. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. But it was sort of quite a fascinating story to get lost down the rabbit hole of this period of Marvel in the 80s in New York. And the sort of simple realization that, you know, there isn't a simple, oh, he was bad, he was good. It was a complicated situation that, you know, everyone involved has an element of that. So it was sort of the death that brought about, I think, the most reading, the most exploring, the disappearing down a rabbit hole of everything related to that. And it is sort of, I would recommend a lot of early Marvel comics. And I think the story of how they were being put together at the time when comics was sort of becoming a huge business in terms of selling direct to comic shops, to sort of a dedicated fan base rather than stuff that was being just thrown out into newsagents and supermarkets. As a hobby, it was becoming far more seriously taken. It had a lot more money behind it. And that transition is clumsy, but the story of that transition is fascinating, and in part because of the way it brings us to the world of comic books that we have today. So those were the sort of losses that struck me this year. As it comes to the rediscoveries, I think there's two that I've sort of really enjoyed. The first was rediscovering the work of Peter Sellers. The British Film Institute in London had a bit of a retrospective of his films, including a lot of the ones that don't get shown that often. And as someone who's probably read my article on the Damn Fine webpage, I'm not the biggest fan of the Pink Panther films, to put it mildly. I think there's he's good in them, but ultimately not many of them I found to be that rewatchable. So it's really good to delve into a lot of the other work that Peter Sellers did and to really admire his comic genius. And I also read the book, The Life and Death of Peter Sellers, which is a sort of warts and all look at the man's private life, which was chaotic, which was horrible. I don't think he was a very nice man in real life. And it is interesting to go from seeing these incredibly charming, brilliant comic performances of such precision that look so effortless, and to learn more about the sort of troubled man behind it. But I think even the use of the word troubled maybe gets him off the hook for some of the horrible things he did. And I've mentioned before, in terms of the looking at, especially at the golden age of Hollywood, that if you're a fan of it, you quickly adjust to accepting that the films and the performances you love have baggage when it comes to the people you made them. And it's interesting with Peter Sellers, you have someone who goes right into the 70s and you're still having to make the same acceptance of the two sides of things. But both sides are fascinating to me, and I don't like the idea of sort of burying and pretending everything was rosy in Peter Sellers' private life when it clearly wasn't. I think it does add something to exploring his films if you know his story. So that was a sort of season at a film festival, but sort of one I've kind of started curating for myself because of the rediscovery that Bob Hoskins was such a good actor. And I know it's sometimes, you know, you say these things that are obvious, but then you go back and you watch his performances and you realize just how good he could be. And I mean, obviously, the greatest of all is Who Framed Roger Rabbit, where he's brilliant. But you watch that back to back with something like The Long Good Friday, where he is as close to Jimmy Cagney, I think, as Hollywood often gets. And it's an incredible performance, a very different performance, but still sort of recognizably Bob Hoskins. He has that Hollywood quality that he can do very different things, but he's still obviously Bob Hoskins. He never disappears into the role. The character has to sort of conform to a great Bob Hoskins performance. And I'm sort of working my way a little bit through a list now, so I still know I've got a few Bob Hoskins performances to rediscover, and I'm definitely looking forward to that. And finally, a new discovery for 2025. The high point, I think, of new films that I've seen this year came as part of the Korean Film Festival in London, and it was a film called 3670 by Park Joon-ho, who's his first film as well, so I'm definitely intrigued as what he does next. It's about a North Korean defector in the South who is also gay and is trying to negotiate his life between adjusting to how odd South Korea is compared to what he grew up with, but also how gay culture works in what is fundamentally quite a conservative society. And I was struck by how effective this film is as a character study, how it didn't have any cheap sentiment to it. Every emotional beat felt incredibly earned. It's also funny. I watched it in a cinema, quite a busy cinema, and it was a lot of laughter there. There's some great comedic scenes. But ultimately, I think it ends in a way that is so, I found so completely satisfying, without it feeling like a sort of cheap, written-in happy ending or downbeat ending. It just felt very, very honest, and I really appreciated that. And also, it was interesting, the buzz coming out of the film, of a room of basically no one had seen that film before. There was a genuine buzz in the air. You could tell people had been excited by it. It had a very positive reaction. And I am definitely looking out for it. If it does get a sort of any sort of general release or a screening somewhere, I'm definitely up for buying a ticket and seeing that again, hopefully one day owning it as well. It was probably my discovery of the year, and I'm really intrigued as to what the director does next. So those are my reflections for 2025. I wish you all out there in the damn fine universe a Merry Christmas, and see you all in 2026.
That's very nice. It's nice that he basically, even with all the losses that Alan found, things to rediscover and new things to discover. That's definitely what you'd want also just in time for Christmas and the holidays.
Oh, yeah. Bob Hoskins, right?
Absolutely. It feels like such a long time since he died by now.
Yeah, but in the words of Roger Rabbit himself, he's a genius.
Yeah, that is very true. Alan's words reminded me that even though this year, I mean, we lost a lot of people, especially in film, I have to say that none of them necessarily felt personal to me. Obviously, there were the tragic losses. The one that probably comes closest to feeling very personal to me is David Lynch's loss, because he's just been around ever since I became a film geek myself. But as Alan said, we have talked a lot about David Lynch this year, and I would refer our listeners to all of those episodes in our Lost Summer. There were, of course, the deaths of Gene Hackman and his wife, Betsy Arakawa. That death, or those deaths, were definitely very tragic in how they happened. And I think they happened very early in the year, very close to David Lynch's death. But they didn't feel personal. They felt tragic, definitely. And talking of tragic losses, obviously, there's the very recent murders of Rob Reiner and Michelle Singer. And that is a tragedy. And of course, it's also horrible how that tragedy has become politicized. But again, I didn't have a personal connection to them. I don't know what it was like for you.
I admired him a great deal. I mean, I think I speak for a lot of us when it's not so much the individual films or Reiner himself, but he's become such a part of the culture. I mean, the amount of times that I've said about something that it goes all the way up to 11, the times I have said inconceivable, or as you wish, or I'll have what she's having, right? He is an integral part, I think, of the culture I grew up in. And even though The Princess Bride is, of course, an important film to me, and so are many of his films, but I think he's so ingrained in pop culture and in our film culture that it's hard to imagine that he's gone.
That is definitely true. Shall we move on to the next contribution from one of our original contributors, creators of this website, Mega?
Hello, listeners. This is Mega with my bit for the Christmas special 2025, right out of a cold, grey, drizzling mid-December evening. I would like to tell you what I lost and what I found. Let's start with the good news. What I found about 3 years ago was a super cheap DVD box set of The X-Files containing all the episodes except for the two movies. I must have bought it 3 years ago, mainly because of Gillian Anderson, I think. Maybe also a little bit because of David Duchovny, but, well, mainly because of Dana Scully. I'm actually not a huge fan of sci-fi. As far as this podcast is concerned, apparently I'm the go-to guy for all things horror and psycho. But flying saucers and aliens, that might sound like it's next door, but I'm not a huge fan. Anyway, I watched it in the last 12 months and I thoroughly enjoyed it, I have to admit. You know, during university, which is quite some years ago, I heard my fellow students talk about the series because they were watching it regularly on Saturday mornings. And the occasional glimpse in one of the episodes let me conclude that it was not for me. Maybe probably also not really that good, lacking in atmosphere. I was wrong. That's a silly thing to say because, you know, if you watch it episode by episode in its entirety, there's a build-up. And I didn't get that because of the occasional glimpse. I didn't stick to it. Didn't interest me back then. You know, all those abductions, those little green men. So I was wrong. I watched it episode for episode. Yeah, there is the occasional episode where I think I don't have to rewatch that again. But on the whole, there's a very good build-up. Stuff is happening. You want to know what happens next. And I also want to know what happens next to Mulder and Scully, because apparently they're planning new episodes, and if they will be released, I'll be there. What I lost the last 2 or 3 years, maybe, is the ability to go to big concerts. I just can't deal with big crowds anymore. I was never really comfortable, but now I have lost the ability to go and see, you know, really big names in huge stadiums. Freaks me out. Don't think I can do it anymore. We made it to Bruce Springsteen 2 years ago. It was an okay concert. You know, the boss played his hits by the number. There was not a lot of back and forth with the audience. I sort of expected more from him. Maybe that was the first concert where I thought, okay, big stadiums, I don't have to do this anymore. I'm no longer able to stand in the middle of huge masses. I need to stand on the edge of the park, and that is where the atmosphere of a good concert maybe never really reaches. It doesn't cross over, at least not to me. We also made it to the Imagine Dragons concert this year, and the concert itself was fantastic. But even there, we were standing on the edge, even if we had tickets for the front row, really, really near the stage. But still, we were standing sort of on one corner of the stage. There has to be a great name on the poster for me to go and see a band in some football arena or whatever. Otherwise, I won't go. It worked very well for me with the Black Keys concert in July of this year, because it was a considerably smaller crowd. And the two guys, the Black Keys, are simply not some super act, but they're dedicated musicians who have fun playing on stage. And that translates really well. The crowd was not big, and I was able to sort of, you know, get soaked with the atmosphere. But I gladly let Ed Sheeran and Taylor Swift and some other big names go. It's just gotten too big for me. Can't do it anymore. Here's wishing you all a very, very Merry Christmas. Keep watching, and thanks for listening to this.
Have you ever been much of a concert goer, going to these big, big concerts by the big acts, Julie?
I was going to say my guy's ahead of the curve. I lost that ability years ago. I don't quite remember when I thought, okay, this is going to drive me crazy. But at some point, it just wasn't worth it anymore. And I know that sounds kind of jaded, and I'm really sorry. I don't mean it that way, but it's just overwhelming. And the older I got, the more overwhelming it got. And at some point I was like, nah, you know. Anyway, I think really huge life events in general, whether it's a concert or whether it's something else, all those people, it just gets to be overwhelming for me. But that's been a long time coming, you know, from my side. I don't really visit concerts. Maybe I think the last concert I went to was perhaps a classical one. But even then, I mean, well, it would have to be something really, really special for me to go all the way to Amsterdam, you know, buy a really expensive ticket, go see a recital. I don't know. No, I think Maga's the hippest one here.
Do you think that this might also talk to us slowly getting older? Probably not. No, it can't
not
be that.
Not at all, Matt. What are you talking about? We just get younger every day.
As vampires do, right?
Exactly.
I have to say that also Maga's mention of the X-Files very much felt like, traveling back in time for me, because I was actually one of those people who back at university, I recorded the episodes for all of us on Sky, because that's where we got them in English. And then we watched them, all the kind of group of nerds that we were at university. And I loved that time. I loved the X-Files at that time. At some point, basically people graduated, people moved away, and I also stopped watching the series. And I'm not sure I want to start watching it again, because it wouldn't be the same as it was back then. And back then it was special. Were you ever much of an X-Files watcher yourself?
No, it wasn't. It never really sort of came into my awareness. That's a weird way of putting it. But there were some series and programs that were just default, that were part of my growing up. And strangely, I'm not sure why. There were sci-fi series that were definitely a part of that. But I don't think X-Files ever sort of made it to the top of my consciousness. Maybe because it wasn't just on TV at a time where I was susceptible to getting into the series. I'm not sure. I don't think I'll sort of buy a box set and start from the very beginning, really, because it's not that meaningful to me.
Talking of meaningful things, I think we can proceed now to our own founds for this year. And I think, Julie, you may be either proud of me for the first thing I want to mention here, or you want to tell me off for only finding it now. Since you are very much the film historian of our team, I mean, together with Alan, but you're also very much the one who's into silent film. Yesterday night, I'm ashamed to say it took this long for me to finally see Metropolis.
Oh, wow. Did you get to see the restored version?
Absolutely, yes. I think it was the 2.5 hour version. And I think that is basically the most complete version of the film that we'll probably ever have, right?
Yeah, the original. That's in a whole Indiana Jones story, how they found the lost footage and patched it back together. Oh, that's fantastic. What did you think?
I mean, obviously, there are certain films when you watch them, you just see 100,000 images that you've seen, you know, refracted and reflected in other films. And I think Metropolis is probably the film where that is most the case. You've seen snippets of the film, even if you've never seen a film, but you've also seen, you've seen Star Wars, you've seen Brazil, you've seen Dark City, you've seen any and everything that uses Metropolis as an inspiration. And what an inspiration it is. I mean, visually, it is still a fantastic film. Obviously, the effects are dated, but they are imaginative and they are effective. It holds up. I think the visuals of this film totally hold up. In terms of its content, I loved the beginning, but I think like so many people, I found myself nonplussed by the ending because it goes from something that I think is much more politically radical than you'd expect. And it ends up with an ending that is just, it betrays the beginning to some extent, but in spite of that and in spite of the 2.5 hours, it was an amazing film and I hope to see it again. And I hope to see it again on a big screen because it's definitely worth it.
Oh, yeah. Read some of the background on the film before you see it for the second time, because I'm always like, for especially these very old films, going into them fresh, right? What's your impression? What's your sort of first sense of the grandeur of it? These map paintings are spectacular. But I think this film sort of benefits by knowing a little bit of its background, again, how it was patched back together, but also who wrote it and why?
I already got some glimpses of that. I think Fritz Lang and his wife, their ideological paths diverged quite a bit. And you can see both of those influences in the film.
They are warring in that film, yeah. I'm so super glad you got to see it, because it really, whatever you think of it and its politics and what it's trying to convey, it is a spectacular piece of work and so very influential, right? It's one of the sort of cornerstones, as you say, of a lot of our modern sense of dystopias and all that. Yeah, fantastic. Wonderful that you saw it, yeah.
And it's also entertaining. I think sometimes with classics, you know, you watch them and you appreciate them and you respect them, and intellectually you totally, you know, your brain is enjoying itself. But sometimes these films can feel a bit like, you know, eat your greens. It's good for you. But then sometimes you come across a classic that's, you know, in this case, almost 100 years old. And you also realize it's just, it's fun to watch. I'm not sure it is entirely fun for the entire 2.5 hours. And obviously you have to get used to some of the wonderfully silent movie overacting. But even that can be part of the enjoyment. It's definitely fun. I mean, sometimes we were laughing with it. Sometimes, I admit, we were laughing at it, especially at some of the performances. But hey, I mean, if we look at some of the films from our childhood that were made then, if we watch them now, I think we also are allowed to roll our eyes at one or two things that they did back then.
Yeah, laughing is absolutely allowed. Yeah.
And another tick in the box of, you know, which classics have I not watched yet and that I am remedying now, is the Rex currently is showing a series of films by Yasujiro Ozu. I'd only this year for the first time ever seen one of his films. You know, I was very much someone who went out and watched all of the Kurosawas. But the other great of basically mid-century Japanese cinema, Ozu, I'd never watched. And I am really, really enjoying them. And especially, I think I'm really enjoying watching a lot of them together because, you know, he reuses the same constellations, he reuses the same motifs, character types, but he always puts them together in slightly different ways. And you feel, or at least I feel, like I'm watching variations of one story, but it's these variations that can be very subtle that change everything. He's often funny, and then it just takes one shot, one gesture, and suddenly it's heartbreaking. And all of that comes across the different cultures, across the decades. It works so well. I'm really, really pleased that we got to see so many of these films, and we've still got one or two of them ahead of us just after Christmas. These are the things that I wanted to point out that I found this year. Metropolis, anyone out there listening to us who hasn't watched it, seek it out. It's well worth it. And the same is true for the films of Ozu. And don't just stop at one film. Watch several of them because they're well worth it. What about you, Julie? What have you perhaps lost but especially found this year?
Well, something that I found, something that was lost, or rather not, I didn't, but I had the opportunity of writing into a Kickstarter that was supposed to polish up an old film that I never heard of with Marion Davies called The Cardboard Lover. And it's supposed to be a comedy. And it has Jette Goodall, which is, of course, as a Dutch woman, a plus. She's one of our screen legends. And you know how this goes, right? You write into this that you would like to participate. It goes through. They restore it. They send you emails, etc. But the found bit is interesting because I just got an email not so long ago that this film, Ben Model is who's doing this project. And he submitted it to the Museum of Modern Art project. And it's called To Save and Project. It's for old films. And it's been submitted and it's going to be shown at the Museum of Modern Art in New York.
Oh, cool.
Isn't that cool? And after all that, I can't fly to New York to see it. But after that, I will get my DVD. And I will. That will be my first time seeing this film. I have never seen it before. So it will be a great found. I don't know when he'll be finished with it. It will be sometime in the new year, I wager. But, you know, sometimes things that were lost can also be shown in the Museum of Modern Art in New York.
Absolutely. That sounds very, very nice.
I love this stuff.
We do have one more contribution this year, obviously, from Sam. So let's move on to Sam's contribution for this Christmas special.
Dear listeners, have you also felt this sense of loss at the end of a year? People gone, filmmakers, actors, actresses, composers, people we spent decades with admiring them. Of course, every year the in memoriam reels are a staple thing of every award ceremony. But this year in particular, I seem to have lost a lot of people that I admired for a very long time. I'm just thinking of actress Diane Keaton or Lalo Schifrin, the composer who created such a powerful sound for the 1960s and 70s. Something that I truly admired that was so ultimately cool. This mix of faux baroque and jazz and his Argentinian influences. Robert Redford, one of the last great Hollywood stars. Or Richard Chamberlain, someone who was maybe better known from television's Thornbirds, but also who had been a prolific actor in the 60s, the 70s and into the 80s. All of them were there almost like forever, it seemed. And especially people like Diane Keaton and Robert Redford, they're also icons, fashion icons, and just icons in with their personalities. And yet, that sense of, especially in some of my favorite eras, like slipping away from underneath of me, the 60s and 70s Hollywood slipping away. And also the question of what's replacing it. Obviously, I've tried to find new things in the meantime, and I'm going to see new films all the time, and also had the chance to be at a festival again, the San Sebastian Film Festival this year. And I had a great appreciation for new films that I saw, for instance, by Yorgos Lanthimos. His Begonia was fantastic. Or François Ozon's The Stranger, such an excellent adaptation of Camus' L'Étranger. I also really liked Agente Secreto, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, the Brazilian thriller that's set in 1970s Brazil and shows corruption in such, you know, poetic and mesmerizing ways. Of course, there's always a chance to read things. Reading biographies, for instance, I got into a John Williams biography by Tim Grieving this year, and I'm really, really enjoying tracing the life of this amazing composer of so many great films. Obviously, there's a chance to dive into podcasts, not just our own, to see reviews or to write them or to help create them for our pods, which is also great fun. And I think new cinema is strong, is political, is sharp. But of course, there's also a lot of nostalgia and nostalgia trash that comes out. I think nostalgia is a good keyword here because I feel that not only Hollywood is revolving around recreating things all the time, things from the past, particularly from the 70s, the 80s. Just think of Star Wars. A ghost cabinet of sequels, of prequels, of remakes. Nostalgia is also a way of not letting go of good things from the past. But it also stands in the way of maybe finding new ground, which can be a liberating process. And I think always going back to the nostalgia closet, and I think there's also a sense of that cinema of the past somehow had something that digitally enhanced cinema doesn't have, kind of this real feeling. There is good material out there, and I think stars are being made. Look at, for instance, the cast of Wicked. Look at Walter Maura, the star from Agente Segreto, or Jonathan Bailey, the new gay superstar of Wicked and Jurassic World Rebirth. The whole cast of Netflix Boots is great as well. So maybe I just have to pull myself out of the nostalgia hole. There will be things that I look forward to immensely. But then looking at what's coming out in the next few months or the next year, I mean, the nostalgia machine is really, really going strong still. I just checked what sequels, prequels, and remakes are coming out next year. Here's a short list. A new 28 Years Later. A second Woodwalkers. A new Wuthering Heights. Scream 7. Scary Movie 6, The Bride, which remakes The Bride of Frankenstein, a new Super Mario movie, The Mummy, again, The Devil Wears Prada Part 2, Mortal Kombat 2, Mandalorian and Grogu, Toy Story 5, a Supergirl remake, Minions 3, another Spider-Man movie, a Cliffhanger remake, a new Resident Evil, Practical Magic 2, a new Shaun the Sheep, a new Hunger Games movie, Fokker in Law, Jumanji 3, Avengers Doomsday, Dune 3 and Angry Birds 3. Wow. I mean, it just goes to show that we are still in this deep hole of just taking things that, even in their original iteration, were not always very good, and remaking them, rehashing them. But among all of that, there's also signs of truly original things on the horizon. And I think film festivals like Berlin, Cannes, Venice, Locarno, Toronto, and San Sebastian, they can show us the light. And I think the films that I saw there, including Bugonia, including Arenda Segreto, including L'Etranger, there were really also signs that there is strong independent cinema. I checked a little bit of what's coming out in the next few months. I'm truly looking forward to Hamnet, the adaptation of a novel about Shakespeare and his son. The Voice of Hinder Jaap, the movie that everybody was going on about at festivals. A true story of the voice of a young Palestinian girl in her last hours, trying to reach out. The President's Cake, a fantastic comedy that won the Audience Award in San Sebastian. L'Etranger, that I've already mentioned, but also Nouvelle Vague, the new film by Richard Linklater, who admires the Nouvelle Vague classic Au Bout du Souffle, the first movie that was directed by Jean-Luc Godard. The History of Sound, the gay love story that stars Paul Mescal and Josh O'Connor. Paul Mescal, of course, is also Shakespeare in Hamlet. The Odyssey, the new Christopher Nolan film starring Matt Damon. There are also films by Iñárritu, Lanthimos, Sorrentino and Assayas. Films of directors that I'm surely going to see that are not part of the nostalgia machine or even the nostalgia trash machine. So let's take this world of losing things as a chance of finding new things. We're at the same time appreciating what was there. I can always go back to Diane Keaton's great roles. The same for Bedford, Chamberlain. I can always pop on a Lalo Schifrin album and hope that John Williams will be around for one more Spielberg or one more Star Wars project. I can still admire the 60s, the 70s and the 80s, but also add slowly but surely in small steps. Because I mean, that's how it happened in the past, right? Not every year saw the release of only fantastic films, even in the decades that I admire. So that's my goal for next year. Share with us in more cinematic goals as you listen to our podcast in the upcoming year. It's been a pleasure having you as our audience, whoever you are, and here's wishing you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year from Sam.
He's right. He is so right. This has been annoying me. I love old movies. I think everybody knows that. But we have to face the past clear-eyed. We can't sit here and pretend we can whitewash the past by redoing a film from the 1950s and pretending that all the bad stuff just didn't happen. And I think it's not just misguided. I think it's dangerous to fall in that kind of nostalgia trap. But I agree. And Sam has so many films on his list that I also have on my list. I would love to see The Secret Agent. It's been singing around on my social media for a very long time to great acclaim. There is stuff there if you're prepared to look and not just click on the first thing that Netflix serves you up.
Absolutely. Obviously, there are things that are scary out there also, not just in the world, but also in the world of entertainment. Look, for instance, at the current battle over Warner Brothers and how much basically this can lead to even more just monoculture and culture devouring itself and regurgitating itself. But at the same time, we are living in a time when there's so much out there that's rich, that's new, that's original, that's fresh, and also stuff that engages with the past in interesting and critical, in worthwhile ways. There's not just a nostalgia machine. There's much more than that. But as you said, one has to go out and look for it. And I think possibly things being just, you know, at the click of a button, just, you know, one click away, makes us lazy. And we have to basically get up and, you know, become active ourselves. But it's not like there isn't worthwhile stuff out there. So many cups of culture that we can enjoy.
Lots of stuff. Yeah, lots of great stuff. And even if it is revisiting past works, there's nothing wrong with that. But I think we have to be clear-eyed about the context in which these were released and made. These are not our times. They are often not analogous to our times. So they have to stay firmly where they belong, namely in their own time.
And obviously 2026, there will be losses, sadly, that we will have to face, as every year. There will be things that we can find. And I think we're definitely up for looking and hopefully finding a lot of cool, fantastic, challenging culture out there next year. I'm sure that you'll join me for many of these expeditions into what can be found, as will Sam and Alan, and hopefully our other friends, partners, contributors. I want to thank the audience, as always, for sticking with us. We want to wish all of you very happy holidays. Enjoy what is left of 2025. And we're looking forward to seeing you and hopefully you hearing us in 2026. Goodbye.
Take care, everyone. Goodbye.